This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Rowan Jacobson. Rowan writes about food, the environment, and the connections between the two. He is the author of the James Beard Award-winning A Geography of Oysters and A Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis, which was named one of the best books of the year by the Toronto Globe and Mail and the Seattle Times. Rowan Jacobson is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Living Shore, Rediscovering a Lost World, published in 2009 by Bloomsbury USA. Welcome, Rowan.
Thanks, Diane. Good to be here again.
It's good to have you. What led you to write The Living Shore?
Well, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book, which you just mentioned, A Geography of Oysters, which was really a consumer's guide to oysters. But while working on that book, I learned about the Olympia oyster, the native oyster on this coast, and became fascinated by it and by the fact that it had virtually disappeared from its entire range. But then through the Puget Sound Restoration Fund, I learned that there were actually a couple of pristine beds of Olympias up on Vancouver Island. And they were taking a trip up there to study them. So I kind of said, can I go? Please, 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 can I go?
What has attracted you personally to oysters as a topic to write about? You wrote the book you just mentioned, and now there's another one about oysters.
Right. Well, and this one is more a straight-up ecology book. My initial interest in oysters, I guess, you know, when I was 12 years old, I just thought they tasted good, and it was kind of wild and daring to eat them. But more recently, well, I guess I've always felt that it was a really sort of primal interaction with the oyster, much more primal than we get with most of our food. And that appealed to me. And then when I started to learn about the incredible ecological benefits that oyster reefs provide for the coasts, that started turning my interest in a whole different direction. And the more I sort of studied our ancient history with oysters, the more I kind of went back to that initial primal experience and realized that shellfish had been a really important and key food for human beings for our entire history.
Would you like to just briefly describe the trip you took to the remote coast of British Columbia to gather the research for your book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. There were 9 people on the trip, and it involved several different organizations. The Puget Sound Restoration Fund was kind of the point organization that was organizing the trip. And there were a couple of scientists aboard working with them, as well as Betsy Peabody, the executive director. But then also there were a couple of people from Vancouver Island University's Center for Shellfish Research, one of whom was the person who had found these beds, and he was really the only person who knew how to get to them. They're way out in Nootka Sound, a very remote section of Vancouver Island. So he was our guide on the trip. And then there's also a man aboard from the Nature Conservancy. The Nature Conservancy's new big push is shellfish reefs, which are actually more endangered than coral reefs, even though we don't hear nearly as much about them. And they're equally important, so that's why the Nature Conservancy is now focusing on them.
What is the importance of oysters and other shellfish in coastal ecosystems?
Well, the scientists refer to oysters as ecosystem engineers. They actually create those coastal habitats that quite a few of the organisms in the sea depend on for their survival, especially when they're juveniles. And oysters serve a few different roles. One is filtration. They're filter feeders. They eat algae. So what they do all day is they filter water through their bodies and strain out the algae to eat. But what that does is that clears the water. And when you've got clear water, sunlight can penetrate the water and get to the bottom of the bays, which allows seagrasses to grow. And crabs and a lot of juvenile fish species and invertebrates depend on either the seagrass beds or the oyster reefs for shelter to hide from predators. So when you get that kind of structure that the oysters create and that clear water, you get the building blocks for the entire food web. Then the other thing oysters do is they kind of act like a living breakwater. When you've got a nice firm oyster bed, it prevents erosion by breaking up the wave action before it can get to the shore.
In your book, you speak of coastal estuaries as the marine equivalent of rich farmland. Would you explain?
Well, you know, on land, when you're farming on land, you add fertilizer. You basically have to add nutrients, particularly nitrogen, to get plants to grow. And really, the same thing is true in the sea. Most of the plants in the sea are single-celled algae, and they need nutrients the same as any land plant does. But in the open ocean, a lot of those nutrients actually sink fairly quickly. So many spots of the open ocean are actually not very rich in life because there just aren't enough nutrients up near the surface for the algae. And algae can have to stay fairly close to the surface because they need sunlight as well. But along the coasts, which are the right depth for algae to get sunlight, you have a fantastic nutrient supply coming from all the rivers. The nutrients that run off in the rivers feed the algae. And of course, this can get out of hand, and then we get algae blooms. But a moderate amount of nutrients running out of the rivers is exactly what you want.
What happens if oysters disappear from a given estuary? How is it different than it was before the oysters were there? What's known about that?
Well, because they eat algae, the oysters keep those algae blooms down. If you've got a really healthy population of oysters filling a bay like they used to before settlers really hit this coast, they really keep the algae populations down, and you get clear water and really abundant supplies of fish and shellfish. And you don't get the dead zones. When the oysters aren't there to take care of that algae and you get the algae blooms, as that algae lives its life cycle and dies and decays, the decomposition process uses up oxygen, and that sucks all the oxygen out of bays. And then you get the fish kills and the crab kills and the things that we're seeing all over both coasts.
How does the presence of oysters in estuaries affect salmon?
You know, that's being studied right now, and there isn't a lot of hard evidence on that. But one thing we do know is that salmon, especially when they're juveniles, they eat little small invertebrates, like little tiny crustaceans. And those crustaceans love to live in oyster reefs. And there have been some studies that have compared sections of bays with oyster reefs to sections that didn't have the oysters. And there was a much better food supply for the salmon in the sections that had the oysters. So the oysters certainly aren't the only factor in salmon health, or even the top one or two, but they're definitely a factor. A rich oyster bed is a big plus for salmon.
What was the geographical distribution of oysters historically compared to now?
On the Pacific coast, the native oyster, the Olympia, was found actually from Panama all the way up to southeast Alaska. But its main habitat was basically from San Francisco Bay up through British Columbia. And it was abundant. It was as abundant and as vital an ecosystem as the redwoods were on this coast. And it's, you know, equally decimated. San Francisco Bay had billions of Olympia oysters. Puget Sound had even more. Those were the two best bays for it. But Willapa was another excellent estuary for Olympias. And they're still found throughout their historic range, but in just very small numbers compared to the massive numbers that used to exist.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Rowan Jacobson, author of the book The Living Shore, Rediscovering a Lost World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. So there aren't as many oysters around. How healthy are the populations that still exist?
Very unhealthy. The Nature Conservancy actually categorizes most of them on this coast as functionally extinct, which means that, yes, you can still find Olympias here and there, but they're not playing that role in the ecosystem that they always played. They're not providing structure. They're not creating habitat anywhere. Few exceptions to that. There are a couple bays in Puget Sound where there are still fairly extensive populations of Olympias. But other than that, there are no healthy populations except for these bays up in British Columbia.
What are the likely causes of the decline?
Well, overharvesting was the main one. If you've seen an Olympia, it's a really small oyster. It's about the size of a 50-cent piece. And it takes it 4 years to get to that size. So compared to the Pacific oyster that's farmed extensively in the Pacific Northwest now, the Olympia is just much more susceptible to overharvesting because it's such a slow grower. So basically, when the gold rush hit and San Francisco exploded from a tiny city to a burgeoning metropolis, the bay got eaten. Like every Olympia in the bay got eaten pretty much, and shockingly quickly. Within a decade, most of them were gone. And then basically San Francisco just started eating its way up the coast until it finally got to Willapa Bay, and then it ate up Willapa Bay and couldn't quite get to Puget Sound because back then it took too long to get the oysters to San Francisco from Puget Sound. They couldn't make the trip alive, so that kind of saved the Puget Sound population for a while. But then The Olympia population in South Sound took a nosedive in 1927 when a pulp mill opened up and started discharging sulfites into the bay.
So habitat destruction also has played a role.
Definitely.
How significant is sea otter predation?
I don't think it's super significant with Olympias in particular, but we were worried about that when we went up there, which is kind of ironic because sea otters have had a tremendous recovery up in British Columbia, and that area now holds the highest concentrations of sea otters in the world, which is great news. It's a great conservation success story. But sea otters each eat about 20 pounds of shellfish a day. So one thing we were wondering, no one had seen these beds in about 14 years until we went up there last year. And one thing we were wondering is whether those healthy sea otter populations might have just eliminated the Olympias. But they hadn't. They were working on clams and gooey ducks and sea urchins instead.
So the places you found in British Columbia where the Olympia oyster still exist, what is the area like there? Is it different from other areas where they're not existing, or is there nothing that distinguishes them?
You know, that's a great question. And that was one of the things we wanted to find out on that trip is, why were these populations so healthy up there? Was something different there than it is in their other areas? And what seemed to be really obvious is that these beaches were very cobbly. There was almost no soft sediment of any kind. It was nice, hard cobble, and the Olympia seemed to love that. And people in other places have found that too. It seems like anytime you get a nice, hard piece of substrate sticking up, the Olympias will colonize it pretty quickly. So they seem very habitat-driven. And they used to have a lot of nice hard substrate on the Pacific coast, but of course, a lot of that nice habitat has disappeared because of the sediment that we load into the rivers, which covers up the hard surface with soft mud.
Looking worldwide, how are oysters doing?
Not very well, which is why the Nature Conservancy is making it a big focus. I just looked at some data from them, and it looks like about 15% of oyster reefs are left from their historical levels, which is maybe half of what's left with coral reefs. So they are an extremely endangered type of habitat. Really, South America seems to be one of the best places that the shellfish are still hanging on.
Would you say more about why you specifically focused on the Olympia oyster? I know, of course, it's a native to this area.
Well, I use it really as kind of a springboard in the book to talk about the importance of restoration, the importance of the coast in general to us, and how they didn't used to just be a vacation area. They were really central to our survival and a really good place for people to live. But I thought the Olympia was kind of a perfect springboard for that because it is such a small, tiny, you might say insignificant little oyster that if you can make a case that that's important, then it sort of falls into place that all the rest is important too. And I kind of had a model there, which was John Steinbeck, who wrote a book in 1940, like fresh off the success of the Grapes of Wrath. He wrote a book called The Log from the Sea of Cortez, which is about a trip he took along the southern half of the Pacific coast of North America, going down to the Baja Peninsula and collecting invertebrates along the shore. So he was kind of doing the same thing we were doing, only he had it in the opposite direction. And he kind of wrestled with the same thing because it was World War II and the country was gearing up for the war. And here he was going off to collect invertebrates. So he sort of felt like he had to justify what he was doing in the same way.
In your book, you mentioned that people pay a lot of attention to salmon, but maybe not so much attention to shellfish in terms of ecology. Would you like to say more?
Well, salmon are, you know, they're kind of sexy in a way that oysters aren't, right? But they're also a federally endangered species. So there's a lot of resources devoted towards salmon because of that, and there's a lot of politics with salmon. And Olympia oysters are not endangered because they are found throughout their historical range. So they're kind of slipping under the radar, and people don't realize they're as important as they are.
Is there any information about how their populations have changed, say, over the last 50 years?
That's a great question. They've actually bounced back a little bit because that pulp mill that I mentioned, I think it closed its doors in 1957. And since then, the water quality of the bay has actually improved from those dark days. I mean, there's still a lot of water quality issues, as we all know. But the Olympias, I think, given a chance, they will bounce back pretty well. If you can get their populations up to a certain level and give them decent habitat, they'll take care of the rest on their own, which is also one of the things I like about them is it seems like some restoration efforts are a lot harder than that with some organisms, that you've really got to coddle them. And oysters are actually pretty resilient, given the right circumstances.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rowan Jacobson, author of the book, The Living Shore, Rediscovering a Lost World. Would you speak now about the evidence for the importance of oysters and other shellfish in human evolution? What have archaeologists found?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. This is pretty new information. It's just come out in some papers in the past year or two. But it's really turning on its head a lot of old ideas we had about human evolution. The old idea was that marine foods, shellfish and fish, were the last addition to the human diet, and a very recent one. But that doesn't look like it's the case anymore. One of the big pieces of evidence that's come up recently was a discovery of a cave right on the very bottom tip of South Africa called Pinnacle Point. And in that cave, and dating to 164,000 years ago, which is exactly when humans were becoming modern humans, they found shells of several different species of shellfish and very sophisticated stone knives and ochre, which is used for body adornment. So this pushed way back the earliest dates we had for consumption of shellfish, for use of advanced stone tools, and for any kind of symbolic behavior, you might call it. Other animals don't tend to draw on themselves with ochre. So this was clearly fully human behavior going on. And the idea is that there was an ice age during that time. The ice age started about 195,000 years ago. Again, exactly when modern human beings first hit the scene physiologically. And that ice age, in the Northern Hemisphere, it would have caused glaciers to cover pretty much everything. But in Africa, it would have caused a major drought, and probably a lot of our food supply dried up, literally. So that probably drove us to the coasts, but it was serendipitous because we discovered a fantastic, super nutritious supply of food, unlike any we'd ever seen before. And it was pretty easy to catch.
Would you speak also about clam gardens and the First Nation people along the West Coast?
This is also something that's just come to light in the last few years. The story starts with a man named John Harper, who's a geomorphologist up in British Columbia. And he had been hired by the province to create an extremely detailed map of the coast for contingency planning in case of an oil spill. And so he was going about doing that. And what he would do is he would fly in a helicopter at about 100 meters right over the shoreline, videotaping to get that super detailed map. And he could create the maps from the videotape he took. And he chose to do it at some of the biggest minus tides of the year so that he'd really get the detail of that low shoreline. But as he was flying and getting all this footage, and all that footage kind of accumulated in his brain, he started realizing that he was seeing a very smooth wall right at the low tide line that looked too smooth. What a geomorphologist is somebody who specializes in natural shapes and topography. And he couldn't think of any natural force that would make such a perfect line. So eventually he set down the helicopter to have a look at it. And what he found was that there was this wall of boulders that had been created right at that ultra-low tide line that was about a meter high and angled slightly to catch sediment and really build up sediment in the intertidal zone. And when he examined the sediment, he found that most of it was clam hash, like crushed up clam shell. And he thought that what he was seeing was basically like a clam terrace or a clam garden that somebody long ago had created in order to enhance butter clam habitat, because the zone that was being created there of that nice, soft, fluffy shell beach, it was like butter clam heaven. So he went to the archaeological powers that be in British Columbia and said, I think that many miles of shoreline was turned into clam gardens centuries ago. And they told him he was out of his mind, and there was no evidence of that in the archaeological records. But he persisted, and then eventually he found some native sources who actually still had clam gardens of their own and showed them to him, and also taught him some songs that had been passed down through the generations about making clam gardens. So with this new evidence, he managed to convince the archaeologists that indeed the native peoples along the Pacific Northwest had enhanced many, many miles of shoreline. It's kind of like the Machu Picchu of the Northwest, and it was right under our noses for all that time.
How did the availability of shellfish likely affect the societies that developed along the coast?
Well, one thing that you see is whenever a culture has great abundant resources that are fairly easy to collect so that they don't have to spend every last hour scraping by trying to get enough food to survive, when they can do that in just a few hours a day and they've got all that free time on their hands, what are they going to do? That's when you start to see art arise in cultures, because you got to have some free time if you're going to switch over from survival to art. And the greatest primitive artistic traditions tend to happen in places with abundant natural resources, and the Pacific Northwest is a fantastic example.
How are shellfish important for our health?
They are kind of the perfect food, super high in protein, and with this incredible suite of vitamins and minerals, and also very good sources of omega-3 fatty acids, which are starting to look more and more important, especially for our mental health. There's some studies coming out showing that DHA, which is the type of omega-3s that are found only in fish and shellfish, have a huge impact on our mental development. Infants who receive a lot of DHA in their diets score much higher on IQ tests than infants who don't, and they actually process information at twice the speed of infants who don't get DHA in their diets. And it's because DHA is a fat that's used by our bodies to create the membranes for our brain cells. And when you use DHA to make those membranes, the cells can fire faster than if you use an inferior material. So our neurons will literally fire faster with a rich supply of DHA.
In your book, you refer to shellfish as the food that made us human. Would you explain?
Well, it's kind of what I was talking about before, that probably 164,000 years ago, you know, somewhere between 150 and 200,000 years ago, when we adapted to a coastal environment, we got much more DHA in our food supply, much more omega-3s, and just an incredible source of protein, probably a much better source of protein than we were getting on land, too. And that enabled us to build much bigger brains than we had before. Without that source in our diet, we just couldn't have built the big brains. And of course, those big brains were kind of central to our existence from then on. There's been a big battle between one camp that feels that hunting, everyone knows that switching from a plant-based diet, like chimps eat, to a more meat-based diet is what allowed us to start to build a bigger brain. But the question has always been, well, how did we start catching the meat if we didn't have the big brain to make the tools to catch the meat? And shellfish kind of fills that gap, because we could have started working on the shellfish even without a fully modern brain.
What are some of the efforts going on to restore and protect oysters?
This is one thing that's really exciting that seems to be just starting to really take off. There are restoration efforts happening all over both coasts right now, and some of them going quite well. On the East Coast, there are some major restoration efforts going on, like in the Chesapeake Bay and in Narragansett Bay and Wellfleet Harbor. Even New York City has now returned oysters to Jamaica Bay, and there's even oysters in the Hudson right now. You wouldn't want to eat them, but they're doing all right, actually. They're surviving quite well. And then also there's oyster gardener programs up and down the coast, where anyone who has some access to the coast, whether a university or an organization or individuals, can grow oysters on their area. They get seed donated to them by various organizations, seed being baby oysters. And then they grow oysters for their filtering ability on the coast. And so there are thousands of people participating in these oyster gardener programs on the East Coast. So you're seeing more and more oysters appear because of that. And on the West Coast, there's also been very successful efforts in Puget Sound. The Puget Sound Restoration Fund has enhanced about 25 acres of Olympia oyster habitat so far. And they've also improved water quality on many hundreds of acres in different bays. And then even San Francisco Bay actually still has some Olympias in it. They just discovered that fairly recently. And so they're just beginning work on some restoration projects there, too.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, you know, one thing I kept thinking about while I was on the trip and then working on the book is what you call the creeping baseline phenomenon, where people forget what things used to be like. And you kind of like whatever you grew up with is what you think the way it's always been. And if it's gotten worse since you were a kid, you definitely are aware of that. But you're not really aware of what it was like before you were a kid. So each generation kind of forgets a little bit. And that's called the creeping baseline. And I think like being up in this really pristine habitat in British Columbia and it feeling incredibly special to me, but then me realizing that quite a bit of our coastlines used to be that special, it just made me realize that the coasts can be a really, really spectacular place for us to live. So yeah, so I think my hope is that people realize the potential of all the estuaries in the United States.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd say, well, just that. Think about what you want the coast to be. One thing that we tend to do with any sort of national park or wilderness effort is to wall off the wilderness and people. And that's good in certain cases. But to me, what's really interesting is the way people interact with the rest of the environment. And so I think the more people think about how they want to be interacting with their coasts, the better.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Rowan.
Thanks, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Rowan Jacobson, author of the book, The Living Shore, Rediscovering a Lost World, published in 2009 by Bloomsbury USA. For more information, check on the web at www.rowanjacobson.com. Again, that's rowanjacobson.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.